Thank you very much. Our next speaker comes to us from Converse College in Spartanburg, South Carolina, where he is Associate Dean. He is also past president of our society. He's had a very distinguished career.
I'm proud of anything else that happens that I'm involved in, but I really am proud of this title. I'd like for us to think about it for a moment. I had it come to me as I was having dinner a few evenings ago. My wife was sitting at the table with me, and I offered it to her, and she didn't quite lose her dinner, but she was severely depressed for the rest of the evening. But I really am not using it because I thought of it. I could hardly have used it if I hadn't thought of it, I suppose. I would much prefer, honestly, to develop conversation with the two gentlemen who preceded me at the podium. However, I think my chance of doing this right now is very limited, so I'd like to proceed to examine, perhaps in a somewhat broader sense, some of what I think I see. I have a few ideas that I would like to throw out. They may become targets. But when I say Sodom and tomorrow, I'm really thinking fairly literally about the two uses of these terms in connection with urban experience throughout many generations and what may or may not occur, no predictions, believe me, in the years to come. Naturally, I prefer to take the long view in making predictions. I would like to tell you exactly what the state of the city will be in the year 2417. This way, you will not be able to check on any of my prognostications unless something fantastic happens in the world of biology and gene change and so on. I really have about five or six questions, and I will simply proceed to those with something like an answer, I suppose. The first one, since so many people are in the city, in our own society, I'd sort of like to raise the question, why is the city so attractive? Why are so many people in it? Well, there are many explanations of this, and Rachel Carson has a new one out, of course, with which I disagree in substantial areas. But the city is, to many people, extremely exciting, extremely attractive, extremely different, and it is different in some very significant ways. Almost any city that we go into has a different set of rules from those which we grew up with, even if we go from one city to another. For example, growing up partly in Atlanta, Georgia, I find it a very exciting experience. It sparkles. The city of San Francisco, everything that doesn't go in Atlanta goes in San Francisco. As a matter of fact, I was out there in the fall, and I discovered that their franchised version of Hair was closing. It was such old stuff to the average San Franciscan that nobody would even buy a ticket to the performance. The city is attractive. We've been told that the city is always the center of civilization, and whatever it generates, pollution or not, spreads through whatever countryside there is there. Since I was required by my father to read the Old Testament, I became concerned many years ago to try to figure out why, with this sparkle, with this attraction, with this looseness, why the city was seen to be so threatening. Why were cities destroyed in the Old Testament days? What is wrong about the city? I finally, a few years ago, tried to develop some inner peace, I suppose, by deciding that the city is probably something that we don't like, something which we think is evil, not because its rules are different, as they usually are, not because there are many different sets of rules within many cities and most of the major cities we know about, we can sort of put up with different sets of rules. The city, however, seems to have a tremendous capacity for eliminating faith in rules per se. Not merely questioning how I part my hair, but questioning the validity of any hair parting ritual. Forgive me for using this simple language. I do this because I don't understand the other kind. To summarize this point, which, as I say, I find somewhat satisfying, when I know about the city, when I go to the city, I find that I can live with your absolutes. I don't have to accept them, but I can live with your absolutes. What I cannot live without is the possibility of absolutes. And I think maybe this is one reason, however implicitly recognized, that we tend, whether we live in the city or outside it, we tend to feel that the city is basically evil. Whether we work there, whether we take our friends and families there, we do have, I think, some dis-ease in connection with the large urban center. Now, the next question that I want to look at, I guess, comes out of a slight conservative streak. We are so exercised these days. I believe we talked this morning about pollution. And after 6 o'clock, I hope we'll change the subject because I don't want any of my friends here to be offended. But I did understand that my name was called during the session, excuse me, this morning. My name was called, and I was supposed to tell you how much atmosphere there is to be polluted. Seriously, I did some research on this a couple of weeks ago, and I can tell you now, if any of you would like to make notes, the total weight of the atmosphere of the Earth is in the general vicinity of 5 million billion tons. That is a lot, as we say in South Carolina, of cotton-picking pollution. But we are concerned about it. Why is our temperature so high in reference to the urban world? Why are we so, I hope this is still in, uptight about it? Why have we forgotten all about history? New York is not the first city in history. I might say that the one I mentioned in my title was not the first city in history. But I'd like to take just a moment and run through a few names of cities to evoke your memories of these cities and try to decide which of them you would prefer to be in comparison with Chicago, for example. And some of you might say, yes, I will not take a poll or a sample or anything today, though it hurts any part-time sociologist not to be able to. Let's start with the city I mentioned in the title, ancient cities, Sodom. Very few cities have influenced language to the degree that this city has influenced it. It has literally come down in history. Since I was serious about my assignment today, I looked into a map of the Near East, and I couldn't find a site for Sodom. It is supposed to be under about 10 or 12 feet of water, in the Red Sea. It had a bright, vigorous life, apparently, a little peculiar by our standards, but they had a life. They had disappeared. Athens, oh, that tells us something. They would not pass our production codes even now, when our production codes have just about disappeared. Rome, beautiful, I'm told. I've never been there. After San Francisco, I don't think I need to go. Rome, however, was a real fun place, as you remember. It was a fun place except for the Christians and the gladiators, who, since someone had to pay, paid. If you feel that we have pornography on our newsstands, I suggest that you read some of Petronius Arbiter. Some of it is so horrible that you have to know how to read Latin in order to read it in all the editions that I have, and I've tried most of them. Now, that's not part of this script, excuse me. We have dozens, we could multiply these illustrations many times. We could talk about the English cities. We could talk about London and the others, which developed primarily before there was an industrial revolution, which is one reason I doubt the new book we have. I think it's fair for me to make a personal statement of thanks. The early British or English cities did develop profusely the production and consumption of gin. And I think that is something they have passed on to us, which is well worth the vicissitudes through which they went during these early years. But let's come a little closer home. I hope that your blood pressure is going down a bit as I try to point to a perspective. New York City. New York City is supposed to have developed into the city it is because the British did not like New York. They used New York as the dump for all of the surplus goods that developed during the War of 1812. Some people say that the nature of the city has not changed since that time. If you think things are bad now, however, in New York, you might, as many of you have already done, you might check out Jacob Riis and see what he described, a very distinguished journalist. You might even look into the publications of some other people there. A man named Herbert Asbury has had a very interesting career writing about the evil cities in the United States. I think I can understand that his grandfather was a very distinguished Methodist bishop. And Asbury, in the third generation, I guess, decided he would find out about all of these things that his grandfather had been preaching about throughout his career. I think I should nod briefly to Chicago, where things were in such a bad shape, a bad situation. A charming spinster, one Jane Addams, looked around the city almost 100 years ago and discovered to her horror that although she was a spinster, most of the men she saw were filthy. The first major contribution she made to Chicago, as I'm able to get it from the history available to me, is the establishment of public baths. The city of Chicago established baths, and of course these dirty men were encouraged to go and clean themselves. They did not import the Japanese tradition, though she may have suggested this on occasion. San Francisco, I have already paid my compliments to. New Orleans, if you haven't been there, you're too late. Around the time of World War I, the army decided to clean it up, and they did a pretty good job. The city in which I lived for many years, Atlanta, Georgia, is a very pleasant, lovable place, and I hope you'll all get down for our meeting next fall. I would say that not so many years ago, the city council of Atlanta met and found that a bunch of hoodlums had a pretty good-sized cannon pointed at the front door of City Hall. They adjourned immediately and departed just before a cannonball went through. I might say this is one of the milder activities of Atlanta. So police protection is good there, and I think if it's safe for me, being a southerner, to come north, you should figure it will be safe for you to go south. Another question. Are we a melting pot? We talk about how we melt, how we assimilate people, how we assimilate types. I'm sure that you know already that a man whose name has already been bandied about here found rather convincingly in the study of New York City that although there was a lot of talk about the melting pot, very little had melted. he found in New York City that there was a truly Catholic world, a truly Protestant world, a truly Jewish world, and a truly black world. That the melting which had been promised just had not occurred. Slightly before this particular book, and if you don't know it, I think you'll find it interesting. It's available in the paperback now. The title, very appropriately, is Beyond the Melting Pot, if you don't know it. Another book which probably didn't receive quite as much attention as this one was written by Eugene Lippmann and Albert Varspan. The title of the book, A Tale of 10 Cities. Apparently they were overdoing a rather famous writer some time before. This was a study of 10 American cities, and the purpose of the study was to determine whether or not we were, as a nation and as cities, integrating, becoming friendly, giving up our commitments to our different and distinguishing traditions. The study was made in Boston, Cleveland, Los Angeles, Muncie, that's in Indiana if any of you don't know, Nashville, New York, Philadelphia, Plainview, and this one shook me. I thought certainly it was in Texas, but this Plainview is in Long Island, Minneapolis, and St. Paul. What they found was that in each of these cities, there was a triple ghetto arrangement, a triple ghetto. The authors deplored the fact that every morning from each of these three areas of the city studied, every morning the Protestants would get up, get in their cars, and drive downtown to work. At work, they would meet the Catholics who had gotten up somewhere else, gotten into their cars and driven in, and of course would meet their Jewish co-workers who had gotten up in their area and driven into town. At 5 o'clock or 4:30 in the afternoon, in effect, the office would sneeze, and the Protestants would go back to their area, the Catholics back to their area, and the Jews back to their areas. The authors in this case, by the way, deplored this. I wrote to the senior author at the time of the appearance of the book, and expressed my appreciation for the opportunity to read it. As a matter of fact, I had to pay for it, but in any case, I told him that if things didn't change, we would find the awful prospect that Protestants might marry Protestants primarily, that Catholics might marry Catholics primarily, and members of the Jewish faith might marry within their own faith primarily. He took me so seriously that I almost cried. I hope it's enough already. Perhaps I have exaggerated in the importance of making this point, but I think it is crucial to anything else I want to say. Once upon a time, as you all remember, there was this old Greek who ran a motel. he had lots of customers, but he had only one size of beds. And when the customer was checked in, they would, of course, measure him. And the bellman would escort him to the bed, and they'd put him in the bed and fasten him in the bed. If the guest were too short, they would stretch him to fit. If he were too long, they would lock off a little bit at one end or the other. And since he was pretty well known in the countryside, I suppose anyone who was locked might as well have been locked off the head. They certainly didn't have much judgment. This fellow's name all of you know, so I won't duplicate anything by telling him. There are many people in the United States who cannot stand ambiguity, who can't stand alternatives, who can't stand contradictions. Therefore, we insist on improving people who present these contradictions to us. We will improve them by, well, we just like to improve them. We have not been able to melt, and we are finding out, unfortunately, the hard way, that people do not want to be melted. And we are finding out specifically that even the people who we want most to help, the black people, want to stay black. They even, in some cases, are so peculiar that they want to continue to talk like they talk. A brother of mine, who is not at this meeting, was horrified when he discovered that the black members of our several communities want to stay in their own schools. Even in Cleveland, they want to stay in their own schools. We haven't melted very well, and since we've been at it for quite a while, perhaps we might consider giving up on the Procrustean approach. Now, when we talk about the city today, we are most concerned with the young people, with the youth. I'm glad to see some very fine representatives, not a problem with the other group here. For many years, we behavioral scientists and we Marxists have been saying that the youth are in trouble because of their environments. Jacob Riis didn't like the housing that the poor people were living in New York, so he worked on that. Housing is very important. Everyone should at least have access to one. However, at the time Riis was working in New York, house had a meaning somewhat different from that which you would expect me to use now. If the housing is not the cause, if people are living in good houses and still produce problems, it's obviously the parents who are to blame. Well, I have several friends who are parents and who are worried to death, who are overwhelmed by feelings of guilt because one or more of their children have gone in directions for which the parent was unprepared, and certainly directions which were not pointed out by the parents. After thinking of this really for several years, I decided to present a paper to the American Sociological Association. That's how I managed to get to San Francisco. It was a new theory of adolescent disorders. I'm going to take just a couple of minutes. My time is running short and your patience thin. I must say first, though, that this paper was not well received. There was lots of chaos and commotion at the meeting in general, but at the table where I was sitting, several people left because they couldn't stand the possibility. Here it is. There is substantial evidence which supports, for me and for some biologists I've talked with, the possibility that this theory explains some erratic behavior. It goes like this. Adolescent problems, at least in part, are caused by interstrain breeding, which produces asymmetrical maturation and produces a low frustration tolerance. Interstrain breeding producing asymmetrical maturation, producing a low frustration tolerance. I hope you noticed I used the word interstrain. I'm not talking about interracial in any sense at this point. There are several reasons for my liking this. Partly it makes me feel fairly comfortable. However, even more importantly to me, the group in our population which is most likely to commit impulsive homicide is taken by most of us to be a homogeneous group genetically. there has been far more interstrain breeding in our black population than in any other segment of our population. They are not all the same. It's possible that through choices, both of whites and blacks, concerning their breeding for a long time, we have produced something which is essentially biological. Unfortunately, this is not optimistic. This has not been proven, but all of the data that I know about contributes favorably to it rather than rejecting it. And the first time I was interested in this came when I learned many years ago that in the old slums, the best kids and the worst kids lived. In the true ghettos, in the Jewish communities, the kids behaved. In the Chinese, the Chinatowns, the kids behaved. Away from these enclaves, the kids were real, real trouble. I have 1 minute. 1 minute. I finished with Sodom, and here is tomorrow. We certainly by now have found out that we do not have a bottle of homogenized milk. We have raw milk. We have been shaken up. We're trying to shake up some more. We thought we were just about homogenized, but we are rapidly separating out again into our component parts. Insofar as we have biologically determined problems of adolescence or of adults, the long view is the only apparent hope. We very probably will face increasing crystallization through the establishment of additional ghettos. We must, one way or another, reduce the level of so-called federalism to the intrastate level, not merely worrying about the relationship that the states have to the federal government. We have several states now, as you know, with far more people in them than the nation had when it was established in 1790. The blacks are going to insist on their ghettos. The blacks are going to insist, as they are insisting, on controlling to some extent their own destinies. You've probably noticed here in Chicago, as in New York some time back, an effort to turn the schools over to the local community. Now, whether this is something I like or dislike, we face apparently a necessity to take this into account. And the last thing, no utopia is coming, you're at next. I think one thing that the mature liberal or conservative must learn, and it's difficult for me, is to learn to hurt a little bit most of the time. Thank you.